Buddhist Summer School, Wednesday afternoon, 31st August 1977.
You may remember one of the important items composing the matter so difficult to see, which the Buddha mentions after the enlightenment. And the first item there is causal uprising by way of condition. Idappachayata paticca samuppada. Now you have on the blackboard a diagram of the 12 items, the 12 nidanas, as they are called, of the paticca samuppada. We will get some idea of the importance attached by the Buddha himself to this paticca samuppada. The Mahavagga, which is one of the books of the discipline, the Vinaya Pitaka, starts off with a statement. At one time, the awakened one, the Lord, being recently fully awakened, was staying at Uruvela on the bank of the river Niranjara at the foot of the tree of awakening. Then the Lord sat cross-legged in one posture for 7 days at the foot of the tree of awakening, experiencing the bliss of freedom. Then the Lord, during the first watch of the night, paid attention to causal uprising in direct and reverse order. He does the same during the second watch of the night, the middle watch, and he does the same during the last watch, the third watch of the night, paying attention to this paticca samuppada in direct and reverse order. After the first watch, after having paid attention in this manner, the Mahavagga goes on, then the Lord, having understood this matter, at that time uttered this solemn utterance. Truly, when things grow plain to the ardent meditating Brahman, his doubts all vanish in that he comprehends thing with cause. The word things is the translation given to the Pali word dhamma, the plural of dhamma. Now the plural of dhamma is a difficult word. It has so many meanings. Things is one meaning, undoubtedly. But it seems to me that in this context we can confine ourselves to mental states rather than to things in general. It does apply to things in general also, but our concern is far more with mental states. This is the utterance at the end of the first watch, that his doubts all vanish in that he comprehends thing, dhamma, with cause. After the second watch, the Lord, having understood this matter, at that time uttered this utterance. Truly, when things grow plain to the ardent meditating Brahman, routing the host of Mara. Mara is evil personified, the evil one. Routing the host of Mara, does he stand, like as the sun when lighting up the sky. And at the end, I beg your pardon, that is what he says at the end of the third watch. At the end of the second watch, he says, truly, when things grow plain to the ardent meditating Brahman, his doubts all vanish in that he discerns destruction of cause. After the first watch, his doubts all vanish in that he comprehends Dhamma and the cause of the mental states. In the second watch, after the second watch, his doubts all vanish in that he discerns destruction of cause. And at the end of the third watch, routing the host of Mara, does he stand like as the sun when lighting up the sky. It is extraordinarily significant the importance that he attaches to this causal uprising, the paticca samuppada, as it is called. Now the 12 constituents, as you will see from the blackboard, start on the left hand, on your left hand side, with avidya, ignorance. That's the first constituent. Then we have, you all know, avidya means ignorance. Then we have sankhara. I will deal with the meanings as we go on. Then we have vijnana, then namarupa, then salayatana, then phasa, vedana, tanha, upadana, bhava, jati, and jaramarana. Now, as you know, jaramarana is associated in the discourses with grief, sorrow, suffering, lamentation, despair. All of them are associated with marana, death. And you remember we saw that death is the central core, the most hurtful aspect of dukkha. And so you have the whole lot of them. Soka parideva dukkha domana sau payasa. Grief, sorrow, suffering, lamentation, despair. Now, the Lord goes through that cycle in direct order, the order in which I read it, and in reverse order. But reverse order means this. The direct order is because of avidya, conditioned by avidya, there are the sankhara, through the condition and through their conditioning, there is vijnana, then there is namarupa and so forth. And then the reverse order means that through the extinction of avidya, of ignorance, there is the extinction of the sankharas, the extinction of vijnana, namarupa, etc., right round. And the extinction after jati, of jaramarana and grief, sorrow,
suffering, lamentation and despair.
He does that during the three watches of the night. It's very significant how important he himself considered that paticca-samuppada. Now, of course, as it stands, it's a closed circle. You see? But when you look at the various texts, you find considerable explanations given. Some are more limited in scope, which clarifies that particular situation fairly well, and some are more extended, and in some of the long discourses, like the Mahapadana and the Mahanidana, the entire cycle is given. And also in the Majjhima Nikaya, the entire circle of 12 is stated. Now, let us first consider what we find in the Saṅyutta Nikaya. There, it is said, depending on both the eye and material forms, there arises visual consciousness. The meeting of these three is called impression or contact. That is, if there is the eye which can see, one is not blind physically, if there is a material object, and if there is attention being paid at the same time, there arises visual consciousness. And the same is worked through with respect to depending upon the ear and the material object and attention, there arises auditory consciousness. You see? And so on with all the senses. And the meeting of these three causes pasa, which is contact or impression. An impression is made upon the psychophysical organism. Because of this impression, there is sensation, vedna, feeling. And then there takes place the uprising of craving. What is missed out is a rather more extended psychological explanation of why and how craving should arise. This depends upon the psychical reaction to the impression, to the sensation or feeling. I like this, I will keep it, I want it repeated, I want more of it. So craving arises. If you get the opposite psychical impression, you get resentment, violence arising. Out of this craving as a hard core, arise other aspects. With the cessation of this very craving, so that no remnant or trace of it remains, there is cessation of grasping. Upadana means grasping. If you crave for a thing, you stretch out your hand, you direct your energies to satisfy this craving. That is upadana. With the cessation of upadana, there is cessation of becoming. What becoming? The obtaining of your desire, of your craving. there is cessation of becoming. With the cessation of becoming, there is the cessation of jati. The actual thing is there. You see? Now, jati, of course, as you know, has so many meanings, birth, rebirth, and in this context, the best meaning for us, in order to understand this, is the conditioned state. The conditioned state arises. In the Mahasudassana Jataka, as well as in the long discourse of the same name, the king Mahasudassana says quite clearly that the moment there is a jati, something has actually come into being, has been born, there is a conditioned state. And as soon as there is a conditioned state, the process of aging and then decay and death sets in. With the cessation of jati, there is the ceasing of decay and death, grief, lamentation, sorrow, dejection and despair. And so the whole cycle ends. Thus there is origination and cessation of this whole aggregation of sorrow. Now, here the uprising of sorrow begins principally with contact through the sense fields and then on to impression, to sensation, to craving and so forth. Then in another sutta, again in the Samyutta Nikaya, the Blessed One says to Ananda, through not understanding this law, mankind cannot get beyond samsara, the ceaseless round. In one who sees enjoyment in notions of grasping and abides therein, craving increases. Now, let us look at it in its 12 constituent form, which starts with avidya. And it says, with the extinction of ignorance, there is the extinction of the conformations, the sankhara, the extinction of the volitions. Perhaps I better use this in order to give all the meanings attached to them. Sankhara also means predispositions and tendencies. And because of sankhara, there is vijnana. Vijnana is first meaning discriminative consciousness, and it can also be translated as cognition, consciousness. And because of cognition and consciousness, there is nama rupa, name and shape or form. name and form, or mind and body. There is another way, a very instructive way, of regarding nama. As you can see from the sound of the Pali word, it is like our English name. The Latin nomen, nominis. But nomen has another very deep meaning. It is the informing principle of anything or creature or person or law of nature or whatever it is. The informing principle. And this meaning was in vogue, particularly during the Middle Ages, amongst the great philosophers and theologians and so forth. The informing principle. That is a very interesting significance of name, the informing principle. You know how a person says, I am so and so. And in giving his name, he gives also an indication of what he does in life and how he influences life around him and so forth. A vital informing principle underlying it all. That's just, by the way, as a matter of interest. And then, because of name and form, the others follow. The six sense fields, salayatana, fassa, sensation or contact, vedana, craving, tanha, grasping, upadana, becoming, bhava, birth, or the conditioned state, or rebirth. Yeah, I mean, bhava gives rise to jati, which is birth or the conditioned state, and birth is inevitably followed by aging, decay, and death, and all the rest of it. But now, let us look at this a little bit carefully. Here we are, living psychophysical organisms. What is the real starting point for us? Our own psychophysical organism, obviously. The living person, nama rupa. Don't forget that. Nama rupa is the starting point. It is this nama rupa who is subject to ignorance, to the sankharas. This nama rupa, and we may add also vijnana, mind and body, and discriminative consciousness in particular. Although the vijnana and nama rupa are presented as two separate items. We'll put the three together, vijnana and nama rupa, nama and rupa. And the teaching goes that by the extinction of ignorance, there is the extinction of the sankharas, the conformations, predispositions, tendencies, the mental constructs, patterns, and so on. All right? By ignorance, one can transcend them. I mean, with the destruction of ignorance, one can transcend them. And then goes on to say that through the destruction of the sankhara, there is the destruction of vijnana, discriminative consciousness. And with the destruction of that, there is the destruction of Nama Rupa. But if Nama Rupa is destroyed, you, the living psychophysical organism, what more is there? How can you proceed onward from there to the destruction of the six sense fields? Of course they are wiped out in any case. And then of course all the rest gets wiped out because there is no Nama Rupa to experience, to grow, to understand, to do, to realize. It's not there. I think this is a slightly faulty way of presenting the situation. Now those of you who have studied the texts as such will have noted that the usual explanations given are along these lines. The avidya, the sankhara and the sankhara belong to past lives. And they are carried over into the next life, which implies a reincarnation. Now listen to what the 14th Dalai Lama has in his book, The Opening of the Wisdom Eye. There is a most interesting note here. He's talking about the same sort of thing, you see, same sort of subject. And in this note, which is entitled Punar Bhava, Punar is the Sanskrit form, and the Pali is Punna, Punna Bhava. Punar Bhava is the Sanskrit form. Punar Bhava, which means literally again becoming. Again becoming, remember. This literal translation preserves the Buddhist emphasis upon dynamic and changing psychological states, a psychology which operates without reference to hypothetical static entities such as soul, atma, etc. On the other hand, one must bear in mind that the Upanishadic atma, which is the unborn, the unaging, the undying, the birthless, sorrowless, deathless, is identical with the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade of the Upanishads. That is the Atma. And conventional orthodox Buddhism has deliberately chosen the misleading conception of the mannequin soul as the meaning of the Atma, simply because in the later Upanishads, it has been presented, I talked about this the other day, smaller than a grain of mustard seed, larger than the largest, etc. You see, the size of a thumb seated in the heart, and people have mistaken it for the physical heart, and so forth. You can wipe all that out. The real meaning is the other meaning. But the word Atma, as used here, is in this rather lesser and mistaken meaning. But now listen to how this note goes on. After saying, without reference to hypothetical static entities, such as soul, atma, etc., reincarnation is a term quite foreign to Buddhist psychology, since it presupposes that which is to incarnate
again, an identifiable entity. Even rebirth is used, the word rebirth is used in Buddhist terminology only for clarity of expression. One only finds birth or jati mentioned in the texts. But for depth of meaning, again becoming punnabhava is much to be preferred. Now notice that the Buddhist texts constantly use the word punnabhava. I haven't come across the word punarjanma, which literally translated is again born in the biological sense, so that something from that which died and completely disintegrated, something immortal, an identifiable entity, has come into birth again in the strict biological sense of the word birth, in another psychophysical organism. Now this is really very important that he has mentioned this here. Punarjanma is mentioned in the Brahmanical Sanskrit writings. But punarjanma does not come in the Buddhist text. Punnabhava, again becoming. Now also consider what is it without which we would know neither suffering nor joy. We would neither understand mortality nor deathlessness. We would neither understand the impure, the ill state, the defiled state, nor the pure state, the state which is completely well, in which the mind has come to full maturity. What is it without which all this couldn't happen? It's the mind. It's the psyche. The Buddha was concerned principally with the psyche. This is the thing that had to be purified. It is to the perfecting of the psyche, to the maturing of the psyche, that the Buddha directs all his teaching. It is this which comes to flower, because without this, the religiousness which is dormant within us and which is coming to fruition in order that man, each individual man, is the true representative of mankind, is our religiousness. And that cannot possibly come to fruition unless it is the psyche which is purified. All our conflict, all our sorrow, all our pleasure and joy and all the rest of it is there because you and I have what we call psyche. Without this, all the rest is not there. There'd be no such thing as enlightenment or unenlightenment. Therefore, consider carefully, this paticca samuppada is essentially directed towards mind. I'll just use the word mind generally, towards mind. Now, the paticca samuppada in its 12 constituent form begins to make good sense. Now you can talk of the extinction of ignorance, avidya.
Ignorance is a thing of the mind. Is it a thing of your bones, your blood, your flesh? It's a thing of the mind. I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, must have read and must know works like Sherrington's Man on His Nature. Modern neurophysiology has come to the point where it is prepared to say that every cell has something of mind in it, if we regard mind as the capacity to learn. And science has discovered that the cell has capacity to learn. If the single cell, and we have what, some 15 billion cells in the average sized body, if the cell has capacity to learn, what a tremendous capacity we as a whole organism have, or should have anyway, to learn. So you see, all this is directed to the mind. Be free of ignorance, and you're free of the conformations, predispositions, and tendencies. The fixed patterns, remember, not those which are quite flexible, which come into being and they pass away, and you let them go without grasping at them. The fixed patterns, now those are no longer going to bind you. We will all have our predispositions and tendencies by virtue of the nature of the organism itself, the physical organism. Our blueprint, so to say, starts with our conception. Hormones and genes and whatnot, all that determines our particular blueprint. After we are born and grow, there is considerable flexibility for the expression of that blueprint. It's not a iron-walled prison, but it does lay down certain predispositions and tendencies, and it does lay down certain limitations beyond which you cannot go. So, the sankhara ceases to be limiting predispositions and tendencies. And when they cease to be limiting agencies, consciousness, vijnana, discriminative consciousness, functions freely. That is, it functions purely, not subject to the tyranny of the ignorant state of the psyche. I like, I want, I must have, I dislike, I don't want, I'll smash it. You see? So, vijnana functions freely and as the proper instrument of the individual here and now. The whole cycle, the paticca-samuppada, is the rationale of the whole thought and feeling process. Look at it that way, and you need not have any such ideas as dragging in past lives or future lives or any such thing, because you'll always be up against this problem posed by the difference between punna bhava and punna janma. You see? Now, we come to the term nama rupa. Now, obviously, this term no longer should be translated as body-mind in its whole sense. That is to say, the physical body and the psyche. Every thought or feeling has its particular shape, hasn't it? It has its particular form. And to all those forms we give names. To all our feelings we give names. To our emotions we give names. All our thoughts, the description of a thought, the structure of a thought is its name. And also, the structure and function, the function of a thought is the informing principle of that thought structure. So we get that other deep meaning of name involved in this. You see how much more sensible it is that way. How much better becomes one's comprehension of the whole Paticca-samuppada, and thereby we understand its extraordinary importance. Then from there, because it's a thought process, it's a thought form which we are dealing with, and the activity of the six sense fields, we get contact, passa, contact, impression. Now you'll see that in this Paticca-samuppada, particularly this way of approaching it and understanding it, numbers 3, 4 and 5, Vijnana, Namarupa and Salayatana, the sense fields and the sense organs, really become one complete whole, don't they? Consciousness, shape and name, and the sense activities. They become a coherent whole, and they become the coherent core because of which all the other items are can be related and make sense. Otherwise, they don't make sense. There is contact impression, and then the rest of it is perfectly straightforward. You can see that because of contact, there arises sensation, and because of sensation and the functioning, continuing function of vijnana, the choice which one exercises, vijnana is not destroyed, therefore, at all. When you look at it this way, the awareness, the consciousness of your thought and feeling can undergo change. And this is what gets changed through the practice of the discipline of the brahmacharya, the holy life. Otherwise, the teaching of the Eightfold Way and all the sealers and so on just goes out of the window. It has no place. And so one well understands the rest of the cycle. Now, birth, jati, one reaches out towards obtaining something. And the reaching out and the becoming is upadana and bhava. And then, if you have obtained it, there it is. Whether it be a physical object, or whether it be some status or condition or achievement in your daily life, etc. There it is. It is manifest. But once it is manifest, whether it be an actual concrete object or a psychological state, it begins to undergo the process of change. It decays. Supposing it is some knowledge which you have obtained. That knowledge does not, must not remain a fixed thing, a changeless thing, otherwise it just becomes an intellectual fossil and obstructs your further development along those lines. You can see in the history of man, and particularly the history of his cultural development and his knowledge of the nature of things, of what he calls the laws of nature and the principles that govern the cosmic process and so forth. These are all mental things, aren't they? Now, if he arrived at a certain discovery and just stayed put there, at the jati stage, you see, the form, the realized form stage, then we'll remain in that conditioned state forever and ever. There's no growth of knowledge. There is no development. There is no growth where we are concerned, where our sensitivity, our refinement, our power of response and of right utilization can grow. What would happen to our lives? You see, it is like that. And so that also undergoes change. It undergoes change in the right way because we do not grasp at what we have discovered and keep it as a fixation. The moment there is a fixation, we are done for. We bind ourselves, and worse still, we exercise bondage upon others. Some of the finest examples of that in history are the philosophies which have given birth to totalitarianisms. Think of the absurdity of the situation. A bright brain comes along, produces, a brilliant brain comes along, produces a great philosophy. Take for example Hegel. Hegel produced a magnificent intellectual structure. He said that the whole cosmic process is a process which is the working out of the scheme in the divine mind. He postulated the divine mind as the origin and source of it all. And he also said this, which is where he fell short. He and Fichte, they both spoke alike there. They accepted the ego as a sort of a final thing, something, an unchanging entity. And the ego, which was a great ego, a powerful ego, and had to realize itself in this life, in life, must of necessity crush, destroy everything that stood in his way. You can relate this to the unhappy laissez-faire which sprang up, particularly in the economic world in the 18th centuries, partly due to the philosophy of John Locke and also David Hume, to a lesser extent, but John Locke in particular, who postulated the soul or the mind as an atom, which was especially your own atom. And it was justified in removing all obstructions which prevented it from obtaining the highest happiness in life. So, everyone was in conflict with everyone else, if or anybody else, who obstructed the fulfillment of this highest happiness in life. You see, these people were intellectuals. They were sometimes mere intellectualists, unaware of the limitations of intellect, unaware of the fact that every single preconception and assumption which they made had no warrant in truth as an absolute unchanging fact of life or nature. This is where they all went wrong. However, Hegel produced a marvelous philosophy. What did Feuerbach do? Feuerbach was the first man. He turned Hegel upside down. And he said, no body, no mind. He didn't work upon the assumption that there is a sort of a spiritual order of things which produces body and so forth. But mind is something supreme. The body is the perishable thing. He said, what nonsense. If there is no living body, there is no mind coming out of that. And Feuerbach inspired Marx and Engels and the others. And see the philosophy raised up by Marx. Marx was a gentle-natured person in himself. It's a strange thing in life, you know, that a person like that, who used his intelligence and who used his good feeling for the suffering poor in the way which he thought was a good and a right way, should give rise to a philosophy in which he made statements which ultimately released a new tyranny. It's the same story with the French Revolution as with the Russian Revolution and so forth. These philosophies are based upon duality at least, if not multiplicity. This against that. There is the oppressor. There is the one who has. Here are the oppressed, the have-nots. And therefore, the have-nots are going to take from the haves. The oppressed are going to destroy the oppressor. But how different? What difference is there between the many oppressed destroying the few oppressors and the few oppressors destroying the many oppressed? It's only a difference in quantity. But the nature of the thing is a destructive thing, a thing born of hate, of envy, of jealousy, of possessiveness. Its technique is violence, craving, and so forth. And what do the many do when they come into power? We talk in terms of democracy. We ought to say mobocracy. This is the end of democracy. The Buddha laid down he was the first to lay down in full the principles of democracy. Do you know that? Did you know that? That he laid them down. We'll talk about that some other time if we have time, but we haven't at the moment. So now, you begin to see how we can understand this paticca-samuppada. And when we come to the point where, because of jati, the conditioned state, there is decay and death, grief, lamentation, etc., and if there is
there is the avoidance, that there is no jati coming in, no conditioned state in which we get imprisoned on the scene, then there is no loss, no destruction. Death of the physical organism, yes, but what of the mind? What of the psyche? Look at it that way, that is a better way. The psyche is utterly free of all those influences which make for dukkha, in the full and the profoundest sense of the term, that unbearable pain of recognizing, born of recognizing the fact that I am not in communion with the one total reality, with transcendence itself. It does away with that. You see, and therefore vijnana becomes so refined, so sensitive, that universal mind functions freely through this psyche and through the instrumentality of this vijnana in order to be completely in tune with, in rhythm with, that ceaseless pulse of creation in eternity. It is that it is because the Holy Ones realized that being in tune with the ceaseless pulse of creation in eternity, that in trying to explain it, they failed. All of them failed. So this idea of repetition and continuity crept in. And in trying to relate this to our little understanding, our incapacity to see that, you see, we talked in terms of repetitiveness, reincarnation, etc. An entity, an identifiable entity, through the centuries, realizing Nibbana. Now we've got it. You see the sadness of it? Got it. And so forth. That is why, as we are particularly as we are what we are at the moment, we cannot step out into the unknown, into the void, into transcendence itself, and find the everlasting arms underneath, the invisible, intangible, everlasting arms, which is the uttermost security from the bonds, as the Buddha said. This is Nibbana, if you like. Now you see the importance of understanding this rationale of the whole process of dukkha. And the paticca-samuppada is a very important thing. There is one aspect of the paticca-samuppada we haven't time to deal with, but it comes in the Saṅyutta Nikāya, the second volume, page 23 onwards, in the translation. Get this from the library, or if you have it at home, the Kindred Book of the Kindred Sayings, volume 2, page 23 onwards. This is the one and only statement along those lines in the entire Pali Canon. This other 12, this closed circle of 12 constituents is stated again and again everywhere. But in this statement, you move out of the prison house of the closed circle of the 12 Nidanas.